This episode of Felon may contain disturbing content, including descriptions of violence and coarse language. Listener discretion is advised.
What do you understand he may have done?
Kill lots of people.
Any idea why?
No idea.
Any idea who he was?
No idea. Not a local, I don't think.
Do you know if any tourists have been involved?
Yes, there have been.
That just sounds awful.
It is awful. It's very, very awful.
April 28th, 1996. A day of horror, of unspeakable violence, and of tragedy that reshaped a nation. But the story of Port Arthur's darkest day did not begin with the first shot. It began decades earlier, in the mind of a man whose life would spiral into infamy. Martin John Bryant was born on May 7th, 1967, in Tasmania, Australia, the firstborn son of Maurice and Carlene Bryant. He grew up in the quiet suburb of Lena Valley, before moving to a property located in Newtown, a suburb of the Tasmanian capital city Hobart. The property was a modest family house situated on Clare Street. It was a standard suburban home with a yard, typical of the area. From the start, there were signs that Martin was different. His mother would later recall that he was an unsettled baby, difficult to soothe, prone to long fits of crying, and often staring blankly, as though disconnected from the world around him. No amount of rocking or gentle words seemed to calm him, and his restless nature made caring for him an exhausting task. His cries were sharp and persistent, sometimes lasting for hours, leaving his parents frustrated and overwhelmed. As he grew into a toddler, his developmental milestones were delayed, and he seemed uninterested in engaging with those around him. Unlike other children, he rarely responded to his name, showed little emotion, and had a peculiar habit of fixating on objects for long periods. He would stare at a single toy, a light fixture, or even his own hands, for what felt like an eternity, seemingly lost in his own world. Attempts to draw him into play or conversation were often met with vacant expressions or a complete lack of acknowledgement. His reluctance to interact with others extended beyond family members when placed in social situations with other children. He seemed bewildered, as though he couldn't grasp the rules of engagement. He would sit alone, watching from a distance, but never joining in, his expression unreadable. His detachment from the world around him became more pronounced as he grew. His mother recalled moments when he would sit silently for hours, seemingly unaffected by the activity and noise of a bustling household. On other occasions, he would erupt into sudden, inexplicable tantrums, screaming and flailing in frustration, though no one could determine what had set him off. Simple tasks like getting dressed or being taken to the grocery store could trigger resistance, and he displayed a strong aversion to any form of routine change. There was an unpredictability to his moods, a stark contrast between his moments of eerie stillness and his bouts of uncontrolled distress. By the time he reached preschool age, it was clear that Martin was not like other children. While his peers were learning to communicate and build friendships, he remained distant and withdrawn. His lack of speech development and emotional responses raised concerns among those around him, but at the time, there was little understanding of the underlying issues. His parents, though troubled, held on to the hope that he would grow out of it, that one day, something would click, and he would begin to engage with the world in the way they had always imagined. Teachers and peers described him as difficult, disruptive, and slow to grasp basic learning concepts. He often struggled to follow instructions, frequently losing focus during lessons, or becoming frustrated when faced with tasks that required concentration. diagnosed with an intellectual disability. His IQ was recorded at 66, well below the average. This cognitive impairment made it nearly impossible for him to keep up with his classmates, and as the academic gap widened, so did his alienation. He struggled in school, both academically and socially. Children avoided him, unsettled by his unpredictable behavior, while teachers found him impossible to control. He would frequently interrupt lessons with outbursts, rocking in his chair, making strange noises, or lashing out when frustrated. He had difficulty processing emotions, often reacting with sudden anger or indifference to situations that would typically elicit empathy or remorse. This behavior would turn increasingly disturbing as he grew older. It was said that he was known to hurt animals, lash out at peers, and display a chilling lack of empathy. Martin's behavior went beyond mere mischief. Stories from his childhood paint a troubling picture. He was known to sneak up on people, scaring them for his own amusement, delighting in their startled reactions. His sister's dolls were frequent victims of his aggression. He would pull their heads off, break their limbs, and scatter the pieces around the house. The destruction seemed less like a tantrum and more like a calculated act of curiosity, as though he wanted to see how things came apart. In an anecdotal account, a neighbor recalled a young Martin shooting at tourists with an air rifle, laughing as they fled in fear. His pranks and disruptions were not just limited to toys or inanimate objects. They extended to real people, sometimes with a menacing edge. He enjoyed seeing others uncomfortable or distressed, an eerie pattern that would persist throughout his life. His mother, Carlene, often found his toys broken and described him as annoying and different, struggling to understand his erratic moods. She later admitted that he was difficult to love, as his emotions were so often cold and detached. He lacked the warmth and connection that most children naturally develop, making his interactions feel unnatural and strained. A psychiatrist who assessed him during his childhood even warned the family that Martin would likely never be capable of holding down a job due to his tendency to aggravate people. This professional insight hinted at deeper issues beyond mere learning difficulties. It suggested an innate inability to connect with others in a meaningful way. As he grew older, these warning signs would only become more pronounced, solidifying the perception that something was deeply wrong with Martin Bryant. His parents, particularly his mother Carlene, struggled to manage him. His father, Maurice, bore the burden of keeping Martin occupied, often taking him on fishing trips or trying to teach him basic skills. But even Maurice couldn't ignore the fact that his son was different. There was an unsettling nature to Martin's gaze, an emptiness that few could explain. His unpredictability made people uneasy. He would shift from calm to explosive aggression without warning. He was known to start small fires in the backyard, watching the flames with a vacant, eerie expression. When questioned about it, he would simply shrug or giggle. His inability to form meaningful friendships became more pronounced as he aged, and by his teenage years, he was fully isolated from his peers. By his teenage years, Martin had become even more isolated. He roamed the streets aimlessly, engaged in acts of petty cruelty, and was notorious for his erratic behavior. His presence unsettled those around him, not just because he lacked social skills, but because there was something undeniably sinister about the way he carried himself. His vacant stares, his unsettling smirks, and his sudden, inexplicable outbursts left people wary. Neighbors recalled a boy who delighted in frightening people, who spoke in an oddly detached manner, and who had no real friends. Unlike other misfit teenagers who struggled with social acceptance, Martin didn't seem to crave companionship or approval. He was content in his isolation, or perhaps indifferent to it. In 1977, Martin was suspended from Newtown Primary School, and psychological assessments noted that he tortured animals, one of the most alarming early indicators of violent tendencies. Reports suggested that he would corner small creatures, cats, birds, even insects, and torment them with a cold, mechanical curiosity. He seemed fascinated by suffering, watching intently as life faded from his victims. Despite these chilling signs, intervention was minimal. Upon his return to school the following year, although his behavior showed some improvement, he continued to tease younger children, often pushing them to tears before walking away, seemingly unaffected. His inability, or refusal, to understand the distress he caused was a trait that would follow him into adulthood. In 1980, he was transferred to a special education unit at Newtown High School, where both his academic performance and behaviour deteriorated. His teachers found him increasingly difficult to manage. He refused to follow basic instructions, displayed sudden violent outbursts, and showed no interest in learning. Other students avoided him, not out of pity, but out of fear. He was unpredictable, sometimes eerily quiet, other times lashing out in sudden fits of rage. His disturbing behavior wasn't confined to the classroom. Outside school, Martin was known for wandering the streets aimlessly, sometimes carrying weapons like air rifles or knives, and terrifying locals with his unpredictable actions. One shopkeeper recalled an incident where Martin entered a store and without a word began stroking a mannequin's face in an unsettling manner, his fingers tracing its lifeless features as he smiled vacantly at other customers. Another story recounts how he would tamper with neighborhood gardens, pulling out plants, breaking branches, or uprooting flowers, not out of anger, but seemingly for no reason other than to provoke a reaction. It was as if he enjoyed the sight of others reacting with confusion or frustration, a small display of power over those around him. As he grew older, Martin began to develop a fixation with weapons and violence. He would often talk about guns and killing in a casual, almost gleeful manner, showing no understanding of the gravity of such subjects. His interest in firearms wasn't the typical fascination of a teenager drawn to action films or war stories. It was deeper, more obsessive. He would linger in hunting stores, running his hands over rifles, as though entranced. At school, his lack of impulse control became more apparent. A teacher once reported that Martin had snuck up behind a fellow student and held a sharp object to their throat, laughing when they screamed in fear. His actions were dismissed as mere troublemaker behavior, but in hindsight, they painted a deeply disturbing picture of a young man spiraling into something far darker. Despite these warning signs, few steps were taken to address his growing instability. His mother, Carlene, often downplayed his actions, attributing them to immaturity rather than a deep-seated issue. Teachers, overwhelmed by his lack of progress and his disruptive tendencies, seemed more relieved to pass him through the system than to intervene. Those who encountered him sensed that something was profoundly wrong, yet his oddities, his cruelty, and his disconnection from reality remained largely unchallenged. It was as though everyone hoped he would simply fade into the background rather than become the nightmare he would one day be. In the late 1980s, Martin Bryant, now a 19-year-old man with limited direction in life, was trying to expand his modest lawn mowing business when he met 54-year-old Helen Harvey, a woman with a considerable inheritance from the Tattersall's lottery fortune. Helen lived in a decaying mansion in Newtown with her elderly mother, Hilza, and had a number of pets, including an excessive number of dogs and cats that roamed freely throughout the house. Despite the mansion's neglected state, Helen and her mother welcomed Bryant into their lives, and he soon became a regular visitor, helping with various tasks around the house, including caring for the animals. The home, which was falling apart from years of neglect, was a reflection of the chaotic and isolated life that Helen and Hilza led. Bryant's presence offered some assistance, though it also appeared to exacerbate the underlying tensions. By 1990, the situation at the mansion had grown dire. Health authorities intervened after an anonymous tip-off, finding both Helen and Hilza in urgent need of medical care. Helen had developed infected ulcers, and Hilza, frail and suffering from a hip fracture, required immediate attention. The home was unsanitary, with conditions so poor that the authorities were forced to act. Hilza was moved to a nursing home, but she passed away a few weeks later, at the age of 79. The mansion, now under investigation for its unsafe conditions, was ordered to be cleaned and restored. In an effort to help, Bryant's father took long-term leave from his job to assist with the massive cleanup. During this time, many of the animals in the home were removed by the RSPCA due to the poor living conditions they were subjected to. Following the cleanup, Helen, likely feeling a sense of gratitude and attachment to Bryant, invited him to live with her in the mansion. What followed has been described as a bizarre and insular existence, one where the lines between companionship, exploitation, and dependency became increasingly blurred. Their relationship puzzled many who knew them. Some saw Bryant as a manipulative opportunist, taking advantage of an older woman's kindness and wealth for his own comfort. Others speculated that Harvey, who had lived much of her life in solitude, viewed Bryant as a surrogate son, someone to care for, and dote upon, in the absence of a real family. Regardless of the dynamic, one thing was certain: their cohabitation only fueled Bryant's growing detachment from reality. With access to Harvey's considerable fortune, Bryant was freed from the responsibilities of work and adulthood. She showered him with expensive gifts and indulged his whims without hesitation. He was given a series of luxury cars, despite not having a driver's license, and was allowed to drive them recklessly through town. He crashed multiple vehicles, but rather than being reprimanded or restricted, he was simply provided with more. Their days were spent on lavish outings, dining at expensive restaurants, buying extravagant and unnecessary items, and indulging in whatever whim struck them at the moment. Bryant, never having experienced financial freedom before, quickly developed a sense of entitlement, as though the world owed him the luxuries he now took for granted. Without any structure or discipline, his already troubling behavior worsened. There were no boundaries, no rules to follow, and no consequences for his actions. He had no obligations or responsibilities, no reason to conform to societal expectations, and no one who held him accountable. His odd and often disturbing tendencies escalated, unchecked by Harvey, who either failed to recognize the extent of his issues or simply chose to ignore them. She never attempted to correct his behavior, instead enabling his reckless and antisocial nature. Bryant thrived in an existence where there were no expectations placed upon him. He lived like a spoiled child, indulged at every turn, and never forced to confront the realities of the world beyond their decaying mansion. With each passing day, he became more disconnected from reality, spiraling further into an existence where his impulses and whims dictated his life, unchecked and unchallenged. In 1991, the situation took a new turn when Bryant and Helen moved to a 29-hectare, 72-acre farm called Taurusville, located in the small township of Copping. The property had been purchased by Helen, and it marked the beginning of a new chapter in their lives. However, Bryant's behavior became even more disturbing. He was frequently seen carrying and shooting an air gun, often aiming it at passing tourists or local dogs that dared to bark at him. Neighbors soon grew wary of him, and many made it clear that they wanted little to do with him, avoiding any interactions at all costs. Bryant's attempts to befriend the residents of Copping were met with cold indifference, and he continued to live in isolation, further alienated by his odd and unsettling behavior. On October 20th, 1992, tragedy struck with a brutal and sudden event that would forever alter the course of several lives. Harvey and Bryant were involved in a harrowing car accident near Copping, a secluded and rural area of Tasmania. The crash was fatal, and Helen died instantly. Bryant, who had been sitting in the passenger seat, was miraculously spared from death, and he sustained only minor injuries. While some speculated that Bryant may have had a hand in the accident, with rumors circulating that he had tampered with the vehicle or in some way contributed to the crash, these claims were never substantiated. There was no evidence to suggest foul play on his part, and the circumstances of the crash remained unclear. What followed, however, would radically change Bryant's life and set him on a dangerous path. In the wake of Helen's death, Bryant inherited a considerable portion of her fortune, reportedly exceeding $500,000. In addition to this substantial sum of money, he also acquired her mansion in Claremont. The inheritance granted Bryant financial independence, allowing him to indulge in his every whim and impulse without fear of limitation. Without the constraints of a typical budget or the need to earn a living, he began to live a life of excess. However, the sudden wealth only highlighted the darker aspects of his character. After Helen's passing, authorities conducted a thorough investigation of her home, uncovering shocking and disturbing conditions within. The mansion, once a symbol of wealth, had become a haven for neglect. The authorities found rotting food strewn about, dead animals scattered throughout the property, and an overwhelming sense of filth that permeated every room. The squalid state of the home painted a grim picture of the environment in which Bryant had lived for years, contributing to his disconnection from reality and his inability to empathize with others. Shortly after Helen's death, Bryant's father, Maurice, took on the responsibility of looking after the Copping property. Maurice, who had long struggled with mental health, seemed to fall deeper into depression. It was during this time that he had discreetly transferred his joint bank account and all property utilities into his wife's name. 14th August 1993, a visitor looking for Morris at the Copping property found him to be absent, and a note simply stating, "Call the police," was pinned to the door. Several $1,000s in cash were visible in his car. When alerted of the situation, police arrived at the property and conducted a search. Initial searches found no trace of Morris, and 2 days later, divers were called to search the four dams on the property. In a tragic twist for the Bryant family, on the 16th August, Maurice's body was discovered in the dam closest to the farmhouse, a diving weight belt around his neck. Maurice's death was ruled a suicide. Following his father's death, Martin Bryant inherited the proceeds of his father's superannuation fund, valued at $250,000, and soon after, sold the Copping farm for $143,000 Australian dollars, electing to keep the former Harvey Mansion as his place of residence. Now living alone, Bryant's appearance began to reflect the wealth he had inherited. His usual attire, consisting of simple white overalls, was replaced with more extravagant clothing. He adopted an eccentric style, often wearing a grey linen suit, a cravat, lizard skin shoes, and a Panama hat, all while carrying a briefcase. He frequently told anyone who would listen that he had a successful career as a high-paying businessman. His behaviour, however, continued to alienate him from others, and he was mocked for his awkward social interactions and strange demeanour. With his newfound wealth and the loss of his father, Bryant embraced a life of recklessness and indulgence. He travelled extensively, visiting various corners of the world, including America, Europe, and Asia. Despite the luxurious nature of his travels, Bryant's deep-rooted social awkwardness prevented him from forming meaningful connections with others. He remained a loner, isolated in his own world, unable to truly engage with the people he encountered. Bryant's behavior became increasingly erratic. He amassed an unsettling collection of firearms, purchasing them even though he had no experience in handling them or any legitimate need for them. These acquisitions only served to deepen his sense of paranoia and detachment. In Hobart's bars, he became a notorious figure, known for his bizarre behavior that often made others uncomfortable. He would laugh inappropriately at odd moments and engage in strange conversations, pushing people away with his unsettling presence. Though wealth had granted him freedom, it also unleashed a darker side of his personality, leading him down a destructive and lonely path that only escalated with time. By 1995, Bryant's mental state had deteriorated significantly. His life, once marked by an unsettling wealth and a growing collection of firearms, was now defined by deep resentment, isolation, and an unhealthy obsession with vengeance. A particular fixation consumed him, one that centered on a property known as the Seascape Guest House, a tranquil yet luxurious retreat situated on the rugged coastline of Tasmania. The guest house was owned by David and Noeline Martin, a couple who, in Bryant's distorted mind, had committed an unforgivable wrong. In reality, the Martins had simply purchased the property, a legal transaction like any other. But to Bryant, this purchase symbolized a much darker betrayal. His father had long harbored an intense desire to acquire Seascape, seeing it as a way to elevate his family's status. When the Martins secured the property instead, Bryant saw it not as a business deal, but as an act of personal theft. In his mind, they'd stolen what was rightfully his family's, an affront that would not be tolerated. Bryant's resentment was deeply rooted in his father's struggles and eventual suicide. His father had long harbored bitter feelings toward the Martins, blaming them for his own failures. Bryant had absorbed these toxic sentiments, fueling his rage even further. He convinced himself that the Martins' success, including their acquisition of Seascape, had been the final straw in his father's mental decline. The strain of this perceived injustice weighed heavily on Bryant, leading him to believe that their actions had directly contributed to his father's death. The grief he felt had warped into an all-consuming hatred, and the Martins were now the focus of his fury. Bryant's bitterness only deepened as he spiraled further into depression. His life was a tangled mess of irrational thoughts, fueled by his warped perception of reality. He increasingly blamed the Martins for every misfortune in his life, from his father's tragic end to the ongoing depression that shadowed his every waking moment. This animosity grew so intense that he saw them as the embodiment of everything that had gone wrong, believing they were personally responsible for his pain and suffering. They were no longer just a couple in possession of a property. They were villains in a narrative he had constructed, the culprits behind his misery. the absence of Helen Harvey in his life allowed Bryant's mental state to further unravel. Without her chaotic influence and the constraints that her presence had once imposed, he became free to act on his most deranged impulses. Helen's death had stripped away any remaining structure or semblance of normality in his world. Where once there might have been some restraint or boundary, now there was only unbridled rage and delusion. His psychotic fantasies, which had long festered in the dark recesses of his mind, began to take on a terrifying reality. The unchecked aggression that had been brewing for years now had no more barriers to hold it back. Bryant's growing arsenal of firearms and ammunition was a symbol of his dangerous mindset. With each new purchase, he fed into his belief that violence was the solution to the wrongs he perceived. His growing detachment from reality, combined with his mental instability, set the stage for a horrifying transformation. What began as an irrational grudge against the couple he felt had wronged his family would soon evolve into something much more catastrophic. Bryant, now fully consumed by his delusions, was about to set in motion one of the deadliest and most shocking mass shootings in history. What had once been a life marked by wealth, isolation, and resentment was now a ticking time bomb, ready to explode in a horrifying act of violence. Martin Bryant's actions on the 28th of April, 1996, at the Port Arthur Historic Site, have left a lasting scar on Tasmania and Australia as a whole. What drove him to kill 35 people? The answers remain elusive, with Bryant providing conflicting and confused accounts of what led to the massacre. But some patterns, some motivations, emerged through the chaos of his fragmented statements. As someone who had been ignored or shunned by society, it could have been a simple desire for attention. At one point, he reportedly told a neighbor, "I'll do something that will make everyone remember me." According to his defense psychiatrist, Dr. Paul Mullen, Bryant's planning of the attack began with an event that occurred 5 months earlier, the Dunblane massacre in Scotland. Dr. Mullen, who was once the chief of forensic psychiatry at Monash University, suggested that Bryant's fascination with the shooter, Thomas Hamilton, changed his trajectory. Before Dunblane, Bryant had been contemplating suicide, but after learning about Hamilton, something snapped. It seems Bryant's descent into darkness began to take shape, much like a twisted mirror reflecting Hamilton's actions from across the globe. The first victims of the Port Arthur massacre were not chosen at random. Bryant made his way to Seascape, the property that has been a source of turmoil for him and his family. It was here that Bryant confronted and attacked David and Noeline Martin, fatally shooting them in the guest house. He stole their weapons and the keys to the property before heading to Port Arthur. Upon arriving at Port Arthur, Bryant made his way to the Broad Arrow Cafe, located within the grounds of the historic site. Carrying a large blue sports bag, he sat down for a meal. Throughout his time there, he made strange, unsettling attempts at conversation. He commented on the absence of wasps and the unusual lack of Japanese tourists, as if trying to draw attention to himself. But soon, his true purpose would become clear. Once he had finished eating, Bryant moved toward the back of the cafe and set up a video camera on a vacant table. He then took out a semi-automatic rifle and, without warning, began firing from the hip. In just 15 seconds, he fired 17 shots, killing 12 people and injuring 10 others. Without hesitation, he moved to another side of the cafe, firing 12 more shots, killing 8 and injuring 2. Bryant then switched magazines and fled the scene. As he drove away in his yellow Volvo 244, he continued his rampage, shooting at people in the cafe's car park and at passing vehicles. By the time he was done, 4 more had been killed and 6 others were wounded. But his violence didn't end there. Just 300 meters down the road, Bryant saw a woman and her 2 children walking. He stopped the car and, without mercy, shot and killed the woman and the child she was carrying. The older child attempted to flee, but Bryant pursued, shooting and killing her with a single shot. He then stole a gold 1980 BMW 7 Series, killing all 4 occupants before driving off. A short distance down the road, he encountered a couple in a white Toyota. Drawing his weapon, he ordered the male occupant into the boot of the BMW, then fired 2 shots into the Toyota's windscreen, killing the female driver. With a hostage in the boot of the car, Bryant returned to Seascape. He set the stolen BMW on fire before taking his hostage inside, where the bodies of the Martins still lay. Bryant arrived at Seascape around 6 p.m. and took his hostage, Glenn Pierce, inside and tied him up. Police alerted to the unfolding massacre arrived at the scene closely behind and surrounded the property, but officers were hesitant to storm the house due to uncertainty about the details of hostages and Bryant's firepower.
At least 25 people are dead and 26 wounded, shot by a crazed gunman who is now holding police at bay and is believed to have a hostage. Most of the victims were tourists visiting the historic penal colony at Port Arthur.
Helicopters began ferrying the injured to Hobart from Port Arthur after a gunman opened fire there this afternoon.
We've had a gunman run amok on the Port Arthur historic site. That's 85 k's from Hobart. Happened mid-afternoon. There are at least 12 confirmed dead, if not 22. There's a further 15 injured, and at the moment we have a hostage-seized situation which we're attempting to contain and control.
From 8 p.m. onwards, Bryant periodically fired at police, forcing them to take cover. He used a military-style semi-automatic rifle, and officers heard multiple gunshots throughout the night. During the standoff, Bryant made several bizarre phone calls to police negotiators who tried to talk him into surrendering. He taunted officers, made strange demands, and appeared incoherent at times. At one point, he falsely claimed to have a helicopter and demanded a ride to Hobart. Reports indicate that police believed there were multiple armed offenders inside the house, not realizing Bryant was alone. This confusion likely contributed to their cautious approach. At approximately 11 p.m., Bryant executed Glenn Pierce, his last hostage. The exact circumstances of Pierce's death remain unclear, but forensic evidence suggests Bryant shot him before setting the house on fire. By 6 a.m. to 7 a.m. on April 29th, the Seascape guest house caught fire, likely due to Bryant accidentally igniting the blaze. Reports suggest he knocked over a lamp or set fire to bedding, leading to a fast-spreading fire in the wooden building. As the flames engulfed the house, Bryant was forced out of the burning structure around 8:30 a.m. His clothes were scorched and he surrendered to police without further resistance. After the fire was extinguished, authorities found the charred remains of David and Nolene Martin, confirming Bryant had killed them earlier in the day. Glenn Pierce's body was also discovered, shot before the fire consumed the property. Bryant was taken to the Royal Hobart Hospital for treatment of burns. The police strategy during the standoff was widely scrutinized. The decision not to storm the house was based on concerns about hostages and uncertainty about Bryant's arsenal. In hindsight, police later admitted they were unaware that the Martins were already dead and that Pierce was the only remaining hostage. The massacre sent shockwaves through Australia, leading to the swift introduction of gun reform laws under then Prime Minister John Howard. Semi-automatic rifles were banned and a nationwide gun buyback program was launched, drastically reducing the number of firearms in civilian hands. He was later charged with 35 counts of murder, 23 counts of attempted murder, and numerous other offences. He pleaded guilty and was sentenced to 35 life sentences without the possibility of parole.
Yesterday afternoon, a 29-year-old gunman began a deadly rampage in a quiet coastal corner of Tasmania's southeast. The historic penal settlement of Port Arthur was crowded with tourists and day trippers. By nightfall, dozens had been mown down and the gunman was holed up with a group of hostages in a nearby cottage. A short time ago, a dramatic climax to the drama, with the cottage on fire and the gunman captured by police.
Police had the guest house surrounded all night, trying to talk the gunman into giving up. He refused, saying he'd killed three hostages being held inside unless officers backed off.
Felon, true crime.